On this edition of Earthwatch, I guess we'll see you next week. I've been Robert Knight. This is WBAI New York.
We invite you, the listener, to send your thoughts and comments about this series of commemorative programs and to share your memories of Robert Knight. A selection will be chosen and presented as part of future broadcasts. Send your emails to thenightreport@gmail.com. Knight is spelled K-N-I-G-H-T, thenightreport@gmail.com. Stay tuned for a live broadcast featuring some of Robert Knight's most illustrious guests. This program was produced by Robert Knight with assistance from Paulette Spencer and Catherine Davis.
The WBAI Community Advisory Board will be attending the hearing on September 4th, starting at 1 p.m. at the New York City Council Chambers at City Hall to endorse the People's Climate March on September 20th. Join us at 12 noon at City Hall in Manhattan to attend this hearing on global climate change at City Hall on September 4th, starting at 1 p.m. Join us for a 10...
And that broadcast was brought to you on recording, and this will not be a live program of Robert Knight. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly live radio program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, Karen Hewler. Just trust me and stay tuned.
Hour of the Wolf movie review, air date September 4th, 2014.
I thought I had edited this part out. Oh, well.
Take one.
Take two. They're small.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. In the new film, The Congress, actress Robin Wright sniffs an ampule of clear liquid and turns into a cartoon. Not actually a cartoon, not even in the context of this film reality. It's an hallucination provided courtesy of her employer, actually her owner, more on that in a second, Miramount Pictures, which in this future world has gone from a purveyor of screen entertainment to faux realities that invade your brain. Robin Wright, the actress whose fame rests mostly on her role in The Princess Bride, plays Robin Wright, an actress whose fame rests mostly on her role in The Princess Bride, and who, in the Congress's opening act set 20 years earlier, allows Miramount to computer scan her physical form and capture her emotional states, to own Robin Wright, essentially, for whatever purpose they may wish. Hint, it's not for a big screen adaptation of The Cherry Orchard. Further hint, in case your intuition happens to leap there, it's not for a version of All-Star Celebrity Behind the Green Door either. Mainstream action film, babe. Statham, not Lovelace. Get your mind out of the gutter. In the main section of the film, Wright is guest at the Futurological Congress, a grand gathering where Miramount will unveil the next step in the evolution of psychotropic-based entertainment, hosted at a company hotel where it's mandatory that every guest don a cartoon guise. And it was with this cartoonish mise-en-scene that the Congress began to trip me up. I've been thinking about this film for over a week now. That I can't quite put it away says a lot to what's good in the film. For all the bitter irony in portraying an industry that has lost its grip on reality, both figuratively and literally, there is also a sadness to this story. The film Wright is given a son who is gradually losing his sight and hearing, involuntarily being forced to live a life within his brain that the rest of the Congress's characters are willingly surrendering themselves to. And in the film's most powerful sequence, which takes place during the live-action portion, Harvey Keitel, playing Wright's agent, provokes the actress through her emotional states during her scanning session, and the performances from Keitel as he tells her a reminiscence that runs from comic to tragic, and from Wright in her reactions, are fantastic. But then there's that cartoon, which largely takes up the last hour of the film. The Congress is based on Stanislaw Lem's The Futurological Congress, with that story's tyranny of pharmaceutical corporations replaced with the tyranny of entertainment conglomerates. Not an inapt modification. But instead of creating a clearly computer-generated virtual reality for the Congress's guests, which frankly is a tired trope at this point, director Ari Folman and his animation partner Yoni Goodman have created a hand-drawn environment that replicates the animation style of circa 1930s cartooning. I flashed on Bob Clampett's work in Looney Tunes during that period. Folman says it's more Fleischer Brothers. Same anarchic difference, I think. And as much as that decision breaks the scenario out of the expected cliché, it doesn't really speak to the Congress's themes. The current entertainment industry isn't really that nostalgic for the past, at least not for much that reaches further back than Terminator 2. And as much as Folman, Goodman, and a collective of animation studios work to replicate the rubbery dynamics of pre-war cartooning, a certain energy is missing, a situation that isn't helped by the cartoon version of Robin Wright, who functions, with the exception of one defiant speech, more as near-mute observer, acted upon and reacting, but doing little to drive the story. Since watching, I've struggled to figure out the relevance of using this brand of animation for this particular story. I keep trying to draw parallels between the delightful anarchy of Looney Tunes and the horrific anarchy that would result when individuals could populate whatever reality they choose and cast their entertainments as they see fit. But it's just as likely that Folman and company just wanted a reason to do some genuine classic animation, one shouldn't discount a cartoonist's innate desire to guide Mickey Mouse through a tap dance or engineer a shotgun exploding in Elmer Fudd's face. But in this case, the palette doesn't feel like it's serving the story. I'm probably going to come back to the Congress at some point. I'm unsatisfied, but also intrigued. A lot of the gambits seem not to work, but are connected to an emotional complexity that makes me want to explore deeper, see if I can find the connections. It may be a failed experiment, but it's also an audacious and exciting one, and that's not to be discounted. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are now archiving these reviews over at mightymoviepodcast.com. And if you love science fiction, fantasy, and horror film, be sure to check out Cinefantastique Online over at cfqonline.com.
Thank you, Dan. Now, I have not yet seen the Congress. I found where it exists online, and I have a free link to it, but as a reviewer, I should say. And I'm a big Stanislaw Lem fan. Solaris is one of my favorite novels, and I liked both movie versions of it. I know that's heresy. You're supposed to either like the Andrei Tarkovsky four-hour Russian version, or you're supposed to love the Steven Soderbergh, George Clooney version of the same novel. Lem liked neither, but I liked both. I thought that Tarkovsky is one of the great science fiction movies up there with 2001. It's, in fact, an answer to 2001, but that's another show. Tarkovsky considered Kubrick the coldest movie director ever, and that's probably an accurate description. But that's one of the things people like about Kubrick. And Tarkovsky was one of the warmest, most humane science fiction movie makers out there. And people should check out The Sacrifice and Stalker and, of course, Solaris. He did Lem very, very, very well. And so here's this other film, and I'm totally intrigued. And I saw this animator's previous film, Waltzing with Bashir, which was an Academy Award. I'm not sure if it was nominee or winner. I think it won for Best Animated Film, about walking along with an Israeli soldier along the Palestine perimeter. He does not shy away from hot topics, and he does not have easy answers, as one would expect from a person living in Israel. He's very conflicted about the conflict. And he's a very warm movie maker himself. So I'm very interested in seeing this film. But I'm going to do the awful thing, and I'm going to wait to reread The Futurological Congress by Lem before I see the movie, which, yeah, it's always going to take any movie down a notch, but I think that's fair. I think, you know, it's like one is an adaptation of the other. I can give the movie its own thing, but I want the comparison. So we shall see, or I shall see, whatever. This is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. With us is Karen Hewler, but first, we have the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings has taken a vacation over the summer, which actually used to be the standard, but we've had such great people sometimes coming in during the summer that, you know, no vacation. Okay, I'll say, okay, in June, okay, this is it for the summer. We'll be back in September or October. Then Paolo Bacigalupi comes to town. It's like, yeah, okay, well, there goes that, and so on. So the last 2 years, no vacation. This year, we took a nice vacation. And in the course of one single weekend at ReaderCon, I booked the first half of the season, and usually we are the first Tuesday of every month, which would have been yesterday. But because we didn't want to hold the event the day after Labor Day, the day after people were getting off holiday and stuff. We postponed it by a week. Now, the way things work at our current space at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, if we're not on the first Tuesday, then we can't use the space. The space has been leased out to an artisan's gallery, and we are now downstairs in their dungeon or cabaret space, depending on how you look at it. And the so we are moving to for one reading and one reading, don't know about only, because I'm going to have to find an alternate space in December as well. You see, the WBAI studios, we're up in Harlem. We're uptown with a capital U. But the offices are in this gorgeous building called the Brooklyn Commons at 388 Atlantic Avenue. And BAI's management is located on the third floor. But the ground floor is this lovely open space, the Brecht Forum, which is a really cool seminar series and all that, which moved there and then died. For reasons I don't know, not involved. They were using the space. And the owner of the building, who is very gracious to WBAI, who has an apiary on the roof of the building, which I think is important, puts the bee back into WBAI, having an apiary there. I am renting the space for one night, and that's next Tuesday, September 9th. And it's a large space. It seats over 100 people. So to make sure that you all are going to come, we have, as a kickoff, Paul DiFilippo, who is an old favorite of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. Paul DiFilippo, I'll do the bios. Paul DiFilippo has published over 30 books. Perhaps his most well-known are The Steampunk Trilogy and Ribofunk. But he's very proud of them all, even his Creature from the Black Lagoon sharecrop novel, Time's Black Lagoon. He's a very offbeat writer, as is Karen, as you will find out. He lives in Lovecraftsburg, Providence, Rhode Island, with his mate of nearly 40 years, Deborah Newton. He has been working or not working on a new novel up around the bend for way too long. He hopes he is at the midpoint of his career. And that's Paul DiFilippo, and he's very bizarre and controversial and fun. Then there's some other guy. Walter Mosley is his name. Walter Mosley is the author of the best-selling mystery series featuring E.Z. Rollins, as well as numerous other works from literary fiction and science fiction to a young adult novel and political monographs. Mosley is the winner of numerous awards, including an O. Henry Award, the Anisfeld Wolf Book Award, a Grammy, and Penn, America's Lifetime Achievement Award. I didn't realize he was a pen person. Karen is a pen person? Nodding yes. He lives in New York City. You've probably heard of Devil with the Blue Dress On. That's a Mosley novel come movie. Helped give Denzel a movie career. And this is actually his second time reading for us. He's a wonderful reader and a nice person. And y'all should come to the reading. That's all. Admission is free. We will bug you for donations for the reading series. And I wouldn't be surprised if somebody comes downstairs from WBAI to hawk you for money. But hey. So that's next Tuesday, September 9th. Doors open at 6:30. Free admission, suggested donation at the Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue. Brooklyn? How can I get to Brooklyn? Let me tell you something. More trains stop near this location than do at Times Square. You can even take the Long Island Railroad to get there, to the Atlantic Avenue Barclay Center spot. It's about seven blocks away from the Barclays Center and about two blocks away from the Hoyt Schermerhorn stop, which I think is like the AC and D or something like that. Consult your favorite map or join the event on Facebook. Look for New York Review of Science Fiction by its letters, NYRSF. And all that. So we'll be serving cider and cheese, all for free. And then we will all go out for dinner afterwards at a Persian restaurant, which I just spoke to them today. They sound like really nice people. So, having said all that and having wasted 20 minutes of the show without even... I don't think that was a waste.
That sounds like a great thing. I'm definitely going to be there.
Yeah, you come to a lot of the readings, and we have to get you at another. Now, you just read last Wednesday at the Evil Sister reading series. We're very, very careful not to double book, which is one of the reasons that we haven't booked Karen yet, is that Ellen Datlow and the Hugo Award-winning editor, Ellen Datlow.
For the fifth time,
and well-deserved, may I say. And Matt Kressel, who is yet to win his first award, but it's going to happen.
Didn't he just win something? Oh, I've forgotten who. I should be much better at this than I am.
No, he was nominated for something.
Is that what it was?
Oh, no, I think he's nominated for World Fantasy Award.
I think it is World Fantasy.
And that's coming up next month.
Okay.
And Rick Bowes is nominated for the World Fantasy as well, very pleased to say. And Rick says that he has never won an award where he's attended the ceremony. And I told...
So he's going.
And he's going. I kept... this was on the air last week. I was like, don't go. You, on the other hand, Karen Hueler, H-E-U-L-E-R. My phone thinks her name is Hoyler. Well, my name is F-R-E-U-N-D. In German, E-U is Oi.
Yeah.
You know, I'm an Oi, but you're you.
Well, I think in Germany it is pronounced Hoyler, but we're here.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people whose name is Freund pronounce it friend.
Yeah.
But it's still E-U, so you could do... And there are people who call me Freund, which I have to say, I don't care for the sound of that.
Freund? No, I don't either.
So a lot of Freunds change their name. John Forsythe. His real name was Freund. It's like John Lincoln Freund. And changed it to Forsythe. Now,
Forsythe just gives you a whole different demographic of readers, doesn't it?
It really does.
Yeah.
It really does.
Maybe I should consider changing my name to something. Oh, I don't know.
I don't think so.
No.
I like Karen Hueler,
yeah,
I think.
I've gotten used to it.
Yeah, it's on books, and people know how to pronounce it on books. Two novels, how many collections?
It's four novels, two collections.
Four novels, two collections. Yeah. That's right. Sorry. Yeah. I was inverting there.
No, it's fine. It's fine. That was my sixth book that just came out, Glorious Plague, from Permuted Press. And we'll chat about that now or later?
Now.
Okay.
Start now. But let me warn listeners, if you are reading this book, have some Indian food handy while you are reading it, because Barbara and I, my partner and I, attended a reading that Karen did, and immediately, since we were downtown, headed for 6th Street right after to get some samosa, because we had no choice in the matter. We got laywayed by a burrito place, but we were going for the samosa.
And the reason for that is because, I'll skip to after the first part, Ganesh, who's an Indian god, runs for mayor. Now, this happens later, of course. I don't know where I originally came across a reference to an NPV virus in insects, and I looked it up, neuropolyhedro something. I forgot it already. I looked it up specifically for this and forgot to write it down. But it's a virus that's usually specific to different kinds of insects. Like, there's one in particular for caterpillars, and I think even distinctly different caterpillars as well as for other bugs. But I came across a reference to it. And one of the things that the virus causes the insect to do is it causes it to crawl to the top of the stalk, where it is not necessarily a good thing for the bug, because at the top of the stalk they get eaten by birds. But in the course of being eaten by birds, the birds actually disseminate the virus through their droppings, so that the virus itself is causing this very weird, what I thought was a very weird thing to do, which is changing behavior in its host. And I just got into a little sort of chain of daydreams about what would happen if this could cross species barrier. What would happen to people? Of course, they would climb to the highest place, but somehow attached to it was this thought that if you go up to the highest point, the people would be singing. And that's what happens. There's a leap from an insect virus, and it crosses the species and becomes a human virus. And in the humans, not only do they climb to the highest place they can find, but they look for a specific song. And when you're first struck by it, you're overwhelmed by a sense of beauty, of glory, of wonder, of awe. And you start listening to all the songs that are being sung, and they're all different. And you continue searching for the song that is the song for you. And then you join the group of people up on the rooftop, on the top of a bridge, in the top of a tree, on a water tower, on a sign, wherever it is. And you join them, and you just sing. And they sing and sing and sing until they die, unfortunately. But this is, it's called Glorious Plague because it is a plague, and we do know that plagues don't end well. So in the course of this, an awful lot of people sing gloriously to their death, and there's a certain number of people who were left who survive. And the bulk of the story takes place in Manhattan as Dale, who lives in rural New Jersey, comes searching for her daughter who lives in Manhattan. And in the course, on the way, as she realizes, because this is spreading, she meets with an entomologist who eventually follows her to Manhattan. All the arteries going into and out of Manhattan are, of course, closed by trucks, buses, cars, or whatever that have been abandoned by the people who have been struck by this plague. Inside Manhattan itself, people try to get New York running again in whatever way, based on who has survived. So they're trying to figure out who's capable of checking on the water supply, on the trains, on whatever. But of course, one of the wonderful things about being the last 10% or so of people in the world is you can be anything you want to be. So people who have always wanted to be a cop, for instance, can suddenly say, oh yeah, I'm a cop. And they can be it without having to prove it. So the New York is trying to get organized. And in the course of trying to get organized, people notice that angels have started landing on rooftops.
Now, up until this point, everything you've described is pretty much straight science fiction.
Yeah, yeah.
Even in the hard-nosed science fiction sense of the word.
Yeah, yeah. And this is probably where it crosses.
Okay. I had that feeling with
yes.
angels. And also, you did make a mention of Ganesh.
Ganesh, yes.
Yes. Having a Hindu god as mayor of New York would be a first.
Yes. At this point, what's starting to happen is this is the plague has passed. That we have the survivors, so we're assuming we're continuing from that point. But angels do get spotted, and then Christ is spotted walking down around Wall Street. Ganesh runs for mayor. Somebody falls in love with a mermaid. So gradually, you, the reader, start noticing that there's a sort of intrusion of beliefs into reality. What people believed in or were attracted to a story starts to become a fact of life. There's one person, that entomologist back there, there's one person who comes searching for Dale, who's looking for her daughter, he's the only one that doesn't see the angels. He doesn't see what everyone else is seeing. And as the story continues and things either get realer or get less real, you have to weigh in as to who is seeing what is actually happening and who is being affected by the plague. So what's real here? Who's right? Who's wrong? Is everyone in the grip of the plague still, or is this an aftermath? Is this a new world, or what's going on? And that's basically...
Are these people left behind?
Yeah, yeah. But that's pretty much it.
Because there's been no rapture.
No, I actually did write a story about the rapture.
Yes, you did.
Okay. All these things are, well, I guess
I've read your stuff.
It's all very fascinating to me. What people believe in is fascinating to me. The idea...
See, this is why I'm upset that you never met Adler, because she was, of course, like Chief Wiccan in the United States. She was the high priestess. They queened her. So she was as close to being... and, of course, she wrote the book Drawing Down the Moon, which I don't know if you've read. But it's pretty much the definitive book on neo-paganism. It's more anthropology than how-to. It's not, oh, you can be a witch and this is how you do magic. It's an anthropological study of Wicca written in the mid-70s. And since she published it in 1978, has never gone out of print. It's very...
Oh, cool.
It's a very admired book. And properly so.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'll get you a copy because I think you would like it. I'm just sorry that you didn't get a chance to talk with her.
Yeah, I am
but
too.
Anyway,
yeah.
Sorry.
Well, it's just one of my obsessions has always been reality. What's reality? Especially because our brain is the only thing that controls reality. There is no such thing as reality apart from what our brain perceives. So for each one of us, we all create our own reality, and there's no right reality, wrong reality. And that always fascinates me. I think I've mentioned before how much I love Oliver Sacks, the man who mistook his wife for a hat. That was a sort of breakthrough event for me in terms of sort of identifying to me. One of the things that interests me so much is that you can be horribly mistaken. Your brain, the computer that is your brain, can be incorrectly programmed occasionally. But is it any less real? I mean, if we identify it as programming in our brain, is it any less real when it's wrong than it is when it's right? Since it's all an interpretation, ultimately. Whether it matches some physical reality, no one can really prove that there is a physical reality, since, again, we're going through an interpretative system. So anyway, I always get stuck on this business of what is reality. And coincident to that, of course, is what is belief, because we all believe that we are in touch with reality in one way or another. And then belief itself becomes an interesting thing for me, because we all perceive an awful lot of the world through our own system or sets of belief. So I keep going back to the same sort of source work.
Is this why, as a writer, you end up writing what turns out to be largely speculative fiction / fantasy? Because you've always struck me not as somebody who said, oh, I love science fiction, I'm going to write SF. It's more to me, I love thinking and the way that your stories work out, the way to explore the things that, if you'll permit me, obsess your stories, inform your literature, delve into works of the imagination.
Yeah. See, I would love to have the kind of concentration to steer me into true science fiction.
Why? What, you know.
There's something I admire about that.
I mean, yeah, but...
Yeah, I mean, as a writer...
Now we're going to get into the philosophical argument of what is true.
I know.
Opposed to false... Well, actually, Lester Del Rey would have said, that's not science. He deplored the idea that Dahlgren, by Samuel R. Delaney, or most anything by Delaney, could have been termed science fiction. And yet, Delaney is one of the great science fiction writers. So
I read Dahlgren when it first came out, I think.
1973.
Yes. And I've got, I said, you know, this is on my list of, I keep going back, all these books, you know, all these books. And I've got to go back and read that again because it was a long time ago. One of the interesting things, which is totally off topic right now.
Took me three times.
Did it?
But yeah. I had to start with To Wound the Autumnal City, and I got through about page 25 the first time, and then page about 50 or 60 the second time, and or at least a couple of WBAI people turned up in the book. and Delaney was the first person I worked for at BAI in 1967 when he was doing radio drama here. And then I finally made it through the 800-and-something pages, and then read it through immediately again because it's a circular book. It starts with the words lowercase To Wound the Autumnal City, and it ends with the words I am here now and I have come to,
and then we start.
Exactly. And it's like, ooh, bleep, he pulled that one off nicely. And he really did. But it's a dense book. It's like Pynchon. You know, it's you have to be looking, you have to be in tune with the voice that these writers use in order to work your way through it. And Dahlgren is like, you know, Joyce or Pynchon or some of these, a very specific voice. And if you're not finding that voice at the moment you're reading it, it's, you know, I would say it's harder than Ulysses, but easier than Finnegan's Wake. And your stuff, on the other hand, is just a read. It's fun, it's accessible, but it's going into similar places.
Yeah, I think I always get hung up on the what if thing, which sounds almost science fiction rather than fantasy-ish. But
and it is science fiction.
Yeah.
The question is, why exclude anything?
I think one of the reasons, I keep trying to figure out where I am, what category I'm in, and I've been through a number of transitions. I thought for many, many years, as you know, I thought I was a literary writer. And I am a literary writer.
Are.
I am a literary writer. But
you're a member of Penn.
I'm a member of Penn. I've won No Henry. I've won a few awards. But most of my stories, and I've published over 70 stories now. I'd say probably the breakdown is 45 literary and the rest, I don't know, somewhere around then. But for years, I was writing literary stories, but a large percentage of my stories were odd. And the stories that I loved the most were the oddest ones, which were pretty much the hardest to get published in literary journals.
Right.
So I rediscovered, I mean, in my 20s, I read nothing but science fiction. And then somehow or other in my 30s, I moved to detective fiction, in addition to literary.
I should mention, by the way, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I was going to mention this earlier. That's the theme of the next reading, the next Nearsif reading. When I told people, I've got Walter Mosley, the first thing people said are, oh, are you going to have Samuel R. Delaney? Are you going to have Nora Jemison? Are you going to have... It's like, no, not on the same month necessarily. I will have them, as a matter of fact. Delaney's in April. I have to talk to Nora. But, you know, it's like, why do you have to put people into a box? And then I came up with it. Paul D. Filippo, who by coincidence has the same publisher, both of them are coming out of Open Road at this point. Their latest books are both from Open Road. Integrated Media is the publisher, which does e-books and all kinds of multimedia publishing. Paul DiFilippo is a science fiction writer who has written mysteries. Walter Mosley is a mystery writer who's written science fiction.
Lovely.
And I said, aha!
Lovely.
You folks want a box? I'll give you a freaking box. But I just wasn't going to go into the racial one. I just, yeah, not that we haven't done it before, but this isn't a celebration of that. And it was just the fact that people automatically assumed that if I had Walter Mosley, I had to have a black writer or a writer of color to pair with him.
Yeah.
Just annoyed me. Well, sorry, but so you mentioned...
No, but that's a great mix. And I mean, one of the things is when genres touch each other, that it just adds to both. So it's a lot of fun to see. Well, it was...
So both
literary writers have been going, hitting genre a lot more lately than they used to. And I know a lot of, or I've heard that a lot of genre writers... goal is to get literary recognition. So
yeah.
There's a lot of talking back and forth.
There are only a few who've really achieved it, like Jonathan Lethal.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, who at one point denied that he was writing science fiction.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course, we who read him knew he was. so that's all we need to know.
But you're a literary... I would say that you're a literary writer who's worked by the necessity of your interests and your background in having read science fiction turns into what Robert Heinlein called speculative fiction.
Yeah.
Everybody forgets that term was coined by Robert Heinlein. They think it's a modern touchy-feely thing. No, it's a phrase from...
I like speculative. And in my 20s, my closest friend then would... And it's just one of these things that is relatively meaningless, but it always stuck in my mind. And I don't know what it was apropos of, but she mentioned in passing that fantasy was the last speculative fiction that we had. And it for some reason, it always stuck in my mind. Or science fiction, it could have been. She was more science fiction reader.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, that term speculative fiction and the sort of enticement that we need a speculative fiction and this is all we have left always interested me without really identifying or attaching any meaning to it specifically. So I've always liked the phrase speculative fiction, and I prefer it to than trying to figure out whether it's fantasy or science fiction.
And it's still SF.
Yes, it still has SF. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot more, I think, openness, fluidity between some literary magic realism. I teach now, and I teach fantastic fiction writing, fairy tales, stuff like that. And I always put on the board in the first day when I'm explaining what these terms are, that there are no separate categories. Every category is just part of a line.
Yeah.
You start with literary, you go to magic realism, you know, and it just the fantasy science fiction. If you can find a slot on that continuum, and there's no door that's slamming shut.
Off air, I have to tell you stories about Margot Adler and Bruno Bettelheim, but...
Okay, that should be good.
Oh, it really is. It really is. And it should be mentioned, in case you didn't know, Margot Adler was the granddaughter of Alfred Adler.
Okay.
As in Freud, Adler, and Jung. So it all ties together. And I want to know, off the air, the difference between a fairy tale and a household tale. The Grimms claimed they wrote...
Fairy, you know, it's a... Well, okay. I have this in my list, too. You know there's a new category of fiction called New Adult?
Yes.
Okay. So we're talking about how do you explain what something is.
Yeah.
And that's the difference between household and fairy tales. It's just...
You know, that's a great answer.
You just came at it from a slightly different marketing approach.
And
you know, who's your audience?
These are all marketing terms,
yes,
we should mention.
They all are.
We're really not discussing literary terms here.
No. We don't sit down and say, aha, today I'm going to write a household tale, and tomorrow I will write a fairy tale.
I should warn you, you would know this if you were wearing headphones, that when you touch the table, even lightly, it makes this lovely, springy reverberation sound that, you know...
Is this a good thing or a bad thing?
It's a good thing if you're a percussionist and a bad thing if you're a writer.
Okay.
if you're Daniel Jose Older, you can get away with it. And then only if you're wearing headphones.
Okay. My apologies. to anyone who was woken up by that.
Oh, no, 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 no. They should be awake, darn it.
So here I am. I mean, what I was just saying is I'm still trying to find my place occasionally. And it, oddly enough, sometimes I'm not quite sure what kind of story I've just finished. Where does it fit? Who do I send it to? You know? And it makes me feel a little uneasy that I can't always identify what it is that I'm writing. The first goal, of course, is write whatever you want. But since I will, after that, send it out somewhere, it's kind of important for me to know where do I send it.
Yeah. Especially because you can only send a story to one place at a time.
In the speculative side, but in the literary side, you can send it to as many as you want.
Really? I've never heard that.
Well, they say...
I know agents who will scream having
No. Literary journals are now taking between 5 to 9 to 11 months to reply.
Yeah.
Years ago...
And several... science fiction, Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet.
That's over a year. It could be.
It's well over a year.
And Tor can be over a year, you know.
Yeah.
It's the way that the response time kept creeping up and up. Years ago, it was acknowledged that no one was paying attention to this no simultaneous submissions thing because it was taking so long to get a response.
That's good.
Number
to
one,
know.
It was just utterly ridiculous to invest a year of waiting for a rejection. And more people simply were ignoring this and going ahead and sending out. When you look at the number of literary magazines there are out there, if you've killed one market, you've got 1,000 more to head to. So there was really basically no damage there.
I mean, Hydra market.
Yeah, yeah. You know, so you really had other options. Of course, you know, if you were smart, every fool sends the New Yorker first. You have to. But you know your tiers.
New Yorker first, Atlantic second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Paris Review. That's my triumvirate. You know, it's just like... But simultaneous submissions...
And by the way, science fiction writers should do the exact same thing. They should. They should.
The science fiction arena is so much tighter and smaller than the literary arena that I've always felt that you sort of can't shake always. I mean, considering that I've only been doing the speculative fiction part of sending and writing.
And another thing I have to talk to you off the air about.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
teaming you up with a New Yorker writer. And you know who I'm talking about, so...
Ah, yes. Yes, I do. I don't know. I mean, it's such a smaller circle in spec fic that... Mm-hmm.
It's inbred.
Like I said, if you annoy one literary magazine, you have 1,000 more to go to. But in fantasy and science fiction, you've got a much smaller... number of people, and it's a larger percentage of the market you've damaged if you do piss someone off.
Yeah, if you've annoyed Neil Clark, then John Joseph Adams and Ellen Datlow,
right? And you're going to keep bumping into them for the rest of your life,
That's right.
So it's and you don't want to do that. So it's quite different.
Yeah,
but occasionally, the puzzle for me is I have a story that can go to either. If I hit. Fantasy and science fiction, I have to wait until I hear from them.
Yeah, except that FNSF.
Well, that was just an...
But I mean, that particular one.
Yeah.
Gordon Van Gelder can send out a rejection before you've submitted the story.
He is quick, so it was a bad example.
And he's very good. I was amazed because I'm familiar, of course, with the rejections my partner has gotten from him. And like 2 years later, I mentioned a story of hers that he rejected, and he remembered the story in detail and why he rejected it. And it's like, he's not just rejecting these. He reads the stuff, and he remembers what he likes or that comes close. And so even though he rejects at an amazing pace, that's largely out of respect to the writer.
It's amazing with the volume of things that he reads that
Yeah.
I mean, that's just phenomenal.
I don't remember
what I read last month.
I was first reader at Galaxy magazine, and I couldn't remember the next day. We had, when I came in there, we had submissions literally up the wall. These were all, of course, this is in the 70s, so these didn't come in email. These were in boxes.
Yeah.
So, I would love to hear some of your fiction. I have a wonderful time talking, but the problem is that it's already 2:18. Would you...
Well, as it so happens, I brought along with me today a story.
Cool. Do you want a break first? Or do you want to delve right in?
I'll jump right in. Do we have to put in a break somewhere?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. I should just say to people that this is WBAI in New York, and that is legally as what they call a break, a station break. And while you are reading, don't mind the fact that I will, A, leave this room to get you some water.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And B, take a few pictures of you while you're reading.
Okay.
If that's okay.
Okay.
Okay, so...
As long as no alarms go off, I think I'll be okay.
This building, I wouldn't be too sure. Okay. We're on campus.
Okay, I'm going to read a story called The Living Wood.
By Karen Hewler. Oh. Copyright... 2014
indeed.
Okay.
Almost last week, 2014.
Now that I've been doing the podcast for Lightspeed, it's like I discovered now it's good to mention the thing. Even the broadcast is copyright, so nobody can actually take the broadcast and use it without permission. But somebody could, in theory, transcribe the story. So it's just good to say.
Got it. Okay.
Author and copyright.
This is my story. Hands off. Okay. Years ago, the village midwife, Mayra, heard a knock on her door first thing in the morning and found her niece there carrying her child wrapped in blankets. "There's something wrong," Ilsa said, her face white and strained. "She doesn't move right." She placed the infant in the crib in the kitchen, which Mayra had set up specifically for Ilsa's visit with her little girl. Mayra bent over and lifted the wrappings away from the child. She lay still, peacefully still, but her chest barely rose with her breaths, and it was hard to know if the child was asleep or dying. Mayra ran her fingers gently along the baby's chin and cheek and removed her shirt and ran her fingers down her arm. All was smooth, though with a peculiar lack of resiliency, yet the skin felt warm enough. Mayra's fingers ran up the child's arms and across her chest and then across her belly, hoping that the sense of touch would give her some clue as to what was wrong. She felt along the child's smooth foot, her index finger poised until it felt a prick. She took her hand away and found a small splinter in her finger. "What is it?" Ilsa asked fearfully. Mayra thought for a moment and then bent down and gently licked the child's hand. "She's made of wood," Mayra said. Ilsa lurched forward and grabbed onto the back of a chair. Her breath caught in her lungs. A second child was found to be made of wood as well, and then a third, and neighbors spread the word as they woke their children up. Soon everyone knew which were wood and which were real. There were 7 children in all who had turned into wood. They were all very young, ranging in age from 11 months to 19 months. Their hearts beat, slowly and with a strange sound, but they beat. These strange children were alive. They opened their eyes and licked milk off fingers and stretched their arms out, but they were slow to smile and never wept. Their mothers kept their hopes up that this strange illness would pass and their little ones would go back to normal. Mayra thought that wouldn't happen. Her grandmother had told her a tale once, when she was very small, about a town where all the horses had been replaced with wooden horses and all the cows. "Listen," she told Ilsa, "my grandmother told me and she heard it from her grandmother about something that happened a long time ago when all the cows in the valley turned to wood. The farmers rose in the morning and went out to milk them or let them out to pasture. And in every barn along the way, the cows stood there as they should, but they were wood. Farmers cried out in despair, for it was almost winter, and the cows were important. And what sort of sorcery was this? Was God in his heaven and the devil on earth? My own grandmother's grandfather wrote out to his neighbors, who were as dismayed as he was. What was to be done? There was a man good with animals who came and listened to the cow to see if he could find a breath or a heart, and he heard it beat, slow and thumping, but beat it did. Witchcraft indeed, the farmers thought, and soon enough they heard of someone who had burned his barn down in terror, only to have rivers of blood stretch out from the door. Their terror only increased. The farmer farthest from town, whose land led to the mountains, was the last to be heard from, the last to be reached, and he told them that he had heard sounds and seen sights that were foreign to his experience, all coming from a tunnel in the side of the mountain, an area known to be lit with an eerie glow on certain nights of the year, and where, if lovers ventured there for privacy, they just as soon fled because of the sounds of whispers and laughter within the walls. They all agreed someone must go through the mountain, but no one wanted to do it until my grandmother's grandmother decided to go. She already had a lump in her breast, and the doctor had shaken his head. "I am as good as dead anyway," she said. "I have a cancer near my heart, and what loss is it if I don't come back? I will at least know I've done something for the rest of you. There's nothing I can do now." Her husband protested with a sullen look and wanted to go with her, but there was the farm, and there were the children, and it made no sense to have two parents dead when one would do. And what I heard was that she was gone for 33 days, and on the 34th day, all the cows were returned to normal. Overnight, the wooden ones were taken back, and the real ones replaced them, except for the farmer who had burned his barn and all the wooden cows within it. He got nothing. Ilse had been silent and unmoving the whole time. "What are you telling me?" she asked. "Do you think this will give me hope? How can anything give me hope ever again? You insist that my child has been stolen in some mysterious way and replaced with something else? My child, I don't care to hear stories." Mayra was silent for some time, trailing her fingers through a shawl that hung on the side of her chair. "I can go," she said finally. "Go where?" Ilse snapped. "To the mountain, of course. I know you were listening." "It's a story," Ilse said, leaning bent over in two and weeping. "It's nothing but a story, to frighten the children and the old fools around the fire. An added shiver for a long, cold night. Do me some good and cure my child." "Ah, well," Mayra said, trying to make her voice sound cheerful. "I'm an old fool now, of course. An old woman should be the one to go." She took her shawl and her bag of implements, knives, needles, thread, for as a midwife she often had to sew things together again, and strode off. She strode through the village and through the fields and got a wave from one and a shout from another, for word spreads fast in desperate times. She got to the farmer who was the farthest from town and knocked on the door for directions. An exceedingly old man with long gray hair looked her up and down. "I've come to find the missing children, and I hope you can tell me where the tunnel is where lovers heard laughter and whispering." He shook his head. "I made that up." Mayra's heart froze. "I'm the one who whispers and laughs," he said. "It's to keep them away. It's to shake their souls. Just an old man's folly." His lips simpered. His eyes glittered. "Can I ask you to come in and sip a drink of cool, clear water with a lonely man? No one ever comes here." He stood back from the doorway, waving her in. He leaned forward a little, as if bent by age, but she had seen him standing straight when he first opened the door. She peered carefully, taking a half step inside. The shadows were too dark for her to make anything out, but she smelled wood and smoke. Common enough, of course. He quickly closed the door once she was all the way in. There were carved faces all along the inside of the cabin. Every inch of wood was chipped at, whittled at, reshaped and modified. Animal faces, tree faces, rock faces, and children's faces. She walked up to the children's faces and touched them. I recognize this one. Magdalena, Betty's daughter. Her hand moved. Amy, Timothy, Roy, Barbara, Ilse's child. She dropped her gaze to the floor so she could think without distraction, and she saw his feet were hardened like a hoof, though with the right number of toes. "You're from the other side of the mountain," she said suddenly. His face distorted queerly. "Not the other side, dear lady, from deep within. But you needn't worry. We're decent folk. Some of us are born with a lust for wandering. I'm one." "You've been here a long time," she said cautiously. "It does that. Go quickly. You turn around and your life is gone." She stood there thinking. She looked up to see him smiling at her with his teeth. "What can I do to get the children back?" she said. He laughed. He turned and got a chair and leaned it so it kept the door from opening. Mayra looked around to see two windows, chest height, closed. She inched her hand to her waist bag, where she kept her knives and her needles. She had one needle already threaded to a spool of coarse black thread. She took her hand out, and he eyed her with amusement. "Are there children missing, then?" he asked easily. Mayra's eyes wandered again to the children's faces carved on the wall. Her mouth tightened. "You're a liar," she said, "and I mean no disrespect. I have met many wonderful liars." The man considered this. "I try not to be offended with that, but in fact I am." "Understandable. But let me ask you, because I am a curious woman, needing to know how things are done. Did you take the human children and replace them with wooden children?" He let the seconds tick by. He didn't mind. Mayra was nearing her own limits, wondering whether now was the time to see if she could get out that door, that window. "Ah," he said finally, "you're a canny woman, I see. You could put two and two together and come up with an interesting tale." "True," she said modestly, "but also the sad story of what really happened. It's easy to tell what has transpired." She lifted her hand to the carvings on all the walls. There was a long silence in the room. "I may have misjudged you," he said reasonably. "Where did you say you were born?" "I was born along a road," she said, "midway between here and there." "That explains it," he said, nodding. "You're neither one of us nor one of them." "I'm pretty much one of them," she said easily, "but I take things as they come sometimes." "Hmm," he said, "I see a fine woman, and I've been missing a fine woman." She inclined her head graciously. "It would be good to have a wife, to clean and cook and take me in at night." She thought it over. "Well, I'd hate to cook for a man who doesn't answer my questions. Seems lonely to me." She glanced around the room slowly. The children's heads were carved into the walls, as were animals and strange creatures she couldn't identify. She didn't know what he was. She didn't know what he knew. She suspected he was no more than a go-between. "Did someone take the children? I mean, did they come to you and ask for them?" "Perhaps," he said heavily against the back of his chair, then leaned forward again, watching her. "And in this perhaps, why did they ask? What did they want them for?" "Oh, you know, old lines of people who have no children of their own, who want fresh blood to liven up their town." "I see," she laughed. "No giants wanting a snack for lunch? No lower people wanting something to sacrifice?" He stiffened. His color ran a little higher. "You do me an injustice. I am kind to all. I sharpen my knives before I kill my meat, so as to cause no pain." He had seen her eyes rest on an animal skin, still fresh. "What skin is that?" "A deer, only a deer." She went over to view it. She needed the time to think, at any rate. "Where's the meat? It's a fresh kill." He was silent. "Do you want meat?" he finally asked. "No, I want the children." "Meat and children together," he said huskily. "You do me a dishonor. But see, I can prove that to you if you come live with me. You'll learn that I am good." "Water," she said abruptly. He poured her some from a pitcher on the table. No, I beg your pardon, but I can't drink water that has been sitting. It's a failing of mine, the only one I can think of at the moment. Can you fetch it fresh from the well? He eyed her, his head pitched a little. Well, then, he said, if that's the way to woo you, I'll do it. His heavy tread let out the door. She could hear him move something against it once he was outside. She wanted the minute to think it over. Meanwhile, she slipped her hand inside her pouch and drew out the large needle with the long, coarse thread and settled herself at a chair, on a chair at the table on the corner next to him. He shifted the door open and leaned a chair against it again. He had a pail of fresh water. He handed her a clean cup from a shelf. Here it is, he said, leaving it for her to dip her cup inside it. He sat down and noted she had moved closer, his eyes looking pleased. Pure water, she said, smacking her lips. She placed the cup on the table and leaned forward on one arm. With the other, she began to sew the leg of his pants to the leg of the table. She was neat and quick with her stitches, bringing her sharp needle through the seam of his pants and around the spindle of his chair. I thought of making a wife out of the wood, he said, eyeing her and leaning into her thread. Did he think she was touching him? But they have to be taught, you know. They get some things right away and some things not at all. How would you know that? She asked. He held her gaze steady, a thoughtful look on his face. His eyes did not dart away, nor did he frown with making an explanation. Instead, he seemed amused. So tell me, she said, you want to have me live with you? What would my life be like? He rolled his eyes. Why, washing and cleaning and cooking, and all the chores a woman does, and you be in my bed at night. Oh, that, she said, casting her eyes down. I'm too old for that. I'll liven you, she laughed. Did you liven the children, too? He frowned. There was a knock one day, and people asked for children. I make a living as I can. They were decent people. So you said. And where did they come from? He shrugged. I didn't ask their address. There are 14 stone doors in the side of the mountain. They came from one of those. I don't go in myself because the worlds behind them shift. I know that for a fact. I came from one. I can never find it. They must have held the door open till they returned, I think. They were good people. And paid well. And paid well. Yes, she said slowly. I hope you didn't sell them cheap. And what did they give you for it? Money? Gold? They gave me living wood, he said. They showed me first what it could do, that it would grow into whatever being you shaped. I have 100 logs from them, all with a beating heart. I like to watch children, and so I carve them. They saw them carved on the wall. He raised his arm to indicate the figures she had already noticed. We came to a deal then, and out of kindness I took one log and carved the children from it. It was just simple curiosity. I thought I would leave new carvings in the real children's place. After all, it's a wondrous thing, this living wood, isn't it? If you live here with me, I'll be generous, and then you can make of it what you will. Imagine horses and dragons and unicorns, if you like. Whatever you describe to me, I'll carve it, and it will raise its head one day and look at you. That's wonderful, truly, she said. The things she had heard of in her life, birds with human faces, hippogriffs, small elephants like walking footstools, the thought of all these possibilities stirred her into longing. But this longing was bought at the expense of the stolen children. She put herself in order. And where is this living wood? He got a cagey grin. You'd like that, wouldn't you? Come take my wood while I'm not looking. Well, it's specially deeded to me. They brought it over to me one night, and it's doing fine where it is, healthy as can be. Ah, she thought to herself, not logs of wood, but trees planted in the earth, not already cut. She cast her eye around the carvings on the wall. Your work is very good, very lifelike. Have you carved out other children in case they come back? That's enough, he said. Don't doubt or question me. That's not a pretty thing for a woman to do. I agree, she said, nodding wisely. But then I'm not a pretty thing. Did you ask if they would treat them well? Did you ask if they would live? Did you ask if that would be a better life for them or worse? I didn't, he said angrily. He placed his hands on the table and braced himself to rise, but he sat back almost immediately. Let me finish this, then, the woman said, and rose up quickly and sewed his sleeve to his knee while he looked to see what had kept him in his seat. He tried to fend her off and toppled sideways, which only gave her room to finish binding him with her heavy thread. She sewed his arms and legs together and wove them to the chair. Her stitches were always one step ahead of his efforts to escape. He was not a quick-moving man. "Now tell me," she said when she was finished, "where did they go?" "I told you everything I know, and I'm not ashamed," he said angrily. "I would do it again, because they're poor here. It's not much of a life. Perhaps they're better off where people want them." "So you tell yourself." "That's all any of us can know," he said. She took the barrier away from the door and opened it. "I'll say farewell then, and in answer to your question as to being your wife and maid and cook and all, I decline." She curtsied to him in a small way and headed out the door. When she got to the next farm, she asked for oil and a match, and so she came back and ran a ring of oil around his house and lit the match. She could hear him stumbling in the house as it caught flames. She took a walk as the house burned, looking for footpaths. She followed one that led toward the mountains until she found scuffed grounds and a small grove of slender trees. She stood within them, listening and watching. She listened and stared so hard she heard the beat of their wooden hearts and saw the bark shift at their deep, slow breaths. She went back to the village and told them all that she had learned. "You say they're not our children?" Ilse said, shouted by the parents of the other exchange children. "They look like them. They've been afflicted. We doubted it at first, but they are ours. We love them. We want them to heal. We want them, whatever they are, and love them, whatever they are. They have eyes, and they watch us." Ilse hung her head. "We watched them back." Mayra had done more than she'd ever done before, journeying far and killing a man, because he'd replaced children unalterably. She looked at the mothers who held their little ones with the slowly beating hearts. She took it on herself to make the wooden children as good as flesh ones. Only half of her journey was finding out what happened. The other half was in repairing it. She spent her time teaching them the things that flesh learns and wood doesn't, all things of spirit and imagination. She taught them when to smile and when to frown, and how to throw their heads back in a laugh. She held her school in the open, in sunlight and rain, because wood doesn't know the difference. Little by little, year by year, the children began to resemble the fluid nature of the other village children. They were eventually accepted. And when a terrible disease took many of the natural children away, Mayra made her way into the far woods, listening for the beating hearts of the trees, and she brought wood back to the woodsmiths in town, who fashioned new children for those who had lost their own. And those children were loved, because though their hearts were different, their hearts were true. End of story.
No, I was just giving it the due pause that it deserved. Nice story. I was looking to see if I could sign on to my music service in time to get something from appropriate from Into the Woods.
Oh, cool. That would have been great.
Yeah.
That would have been great.
No, it was.
It's got a fairy tale-ish feel to it.
It very much does.
It just doesn't follow. There is an actual, there are rules about how you write fairy tales. So it's not actually following the rules, which is the three the trials and stuff like that. But
yeah.
But it has the feel.
Yeah, it really does. But then again, I won't get into that now. I have had a problem with a fairy tale movie that I think breaks the rule that everybody loves, and that's Pan's Labyrinth.
My memory is not the best. I did see it, and I think there was a part. Yeah, my memory is so bad.
There's three trials and all that, and of course the third trial is, and when you get there, you must not eat or drink anything in that room, and of course
she does.
And of course she does.
Yeah.
But the problem is that they never tell us why.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, let's make it.
Don't touch your nose, whatever you do.
But why?
Why?
Yeah. Why does she break that rule? It's the only thing. Her life, her mother's life, everything is at stake. And she breaks that rule. Now, I can buy that the purpose for rules and fairy tales is that something happens that makes you break that rule.
Because there is a tradition to this whole thing of never eating In the underworld, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
You commit yourself to that world once you eat, once you partake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's actually not what happens. She commits herself to the real world, which is a horrible world and could be an underworld, in fact, except that it's a real world, the world of the Spanish Revolution at the time.
Right.
And but what is at risk is her mother's life,
mm-hmm.
okay? And by eating, her mother is killed, there's a horrible, sad ending, and all that. And one could buy that except for one problem. Why does she eat? There's only one thing she must not do. She's completed the task. She's on her way out. She steps from victory. And she breaks the rule.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is like, okay, you know, you need to do that. Tell us why.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe it's on the cutting room floor, except it's not on the DVD of the movie. And everybody I talk to is like, well, that's the way it is. It's like, no.
No, there's a reason for everything, yeah.
Yeah, fairy tales have rules. These are not just magical lands that people make up. They are essential. They are important. Read Tolkien's essay entitled On Fairy Tales. It's like 80 pages long. It's genius. Fairy tales have rules. I love that there seems to be a return to the fairy tale from a lot of wonderful writers. Rick Bowes has a book of fairy tales out, The Seven Campions and other stories, and Theodora Goss, who almost always writes primarily fairy tales, has a science fiction-ish book out that uses the fairy tale trope.
That sounds enticing.
Yeah,
I love that.
And there used to be a tradition on Hour of the Wolf, when I could count an Hour of the Wolf being on at a good time in every week, where every October we did nothing but either fantasy and often specifically fairy tales. And that was it. That was the entire October.
Well, you know, sometimes I go
3 months instead of 1 month.
The wonderful thing about fairy tales is they are fundamentally a guide to dealing with social structure in one way or another. So there are warnings about behavior in there. There are inducements to try and be the kind of child who can succeed. For the boy, that's to end up having a good job and money, and for the girl is to end up marrying the guy with the good job and the money. But I think one of the reasons why fairy tales appeal to us is harkening back to that childhood sense that there are mysteries in the very mundane things in life, and how are they going to figure it out?
Yeah.
And that's what fairy tales are all about. So it's hitting some... We don't necessarily have the one-to-one correspondence that for the older fairy tales, living in a very difficult world, it's okay to kill giants to steal its gold, you know, because you have to learn to survive.
That's always been a moral, by today's light.
Yeah, there are lots of questionable things.
Like, yeah, there really are.
But it addresses some fundamental issues we have. Is how do we survive? How do we deal appropriately with the society we're living in? How do we decode it and figure out how do I succeed?
Yeah.
And so fairy tales, I think, address that sort of need to have a guide.
And they're essential to every society and every place. And when you don't have them, you have a substitute.
Yeah.
So when you don't have modern fairy tales, you have, or mythology, which is a different form of ethical, moral stories for guidance, then you have fantasy and science fiction, I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
Joanna Russ and Darko Suvin were two critics who used to argue exactly that science fiction is the mythology of today. Since we don't have mythology today, We have science fiction instead.
And the beauty of science fiction and fantasy is you can really address broader issues much more adeptly than you can in your stories about divorce.
Yeah, right.
Sorry.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, you can really hit things. Social problems mm-hmm. are more easily addressed by setting them on different planets with people who don't look exactly like us.
Taking what has been classically called the alien viewpoint.
Yes, and it's, you know, just as Bradbury did in the Martian Chronicles, you know, when he distinctly made the parallel between Indians and Martians
yeah.
in terms of what we do to the colonies of the indigenous peoples, make them disappear one way or another. So he was able to use space exploration as a very handy way of pointing out our errors mm-hmm. without getting people's backs up about, you know, who did what to whom. So, I mean, there's an awful lot you can do with fantasy and science fiction in addressing an awful lot of stuff. It's just, I think it's very handy.
Yeah, and it does work in that area. And I became just thoroughly fascinated with fairy tales and being of German descent, particularly in the household tales, as they're so-called, of the Grimms, of the Brothers yeah. Grimm. Most people, of course, come through the Perrault passages, as it were, from the French salons of the 18th century. But in the early 19th century, the Grimms are taking the same stories and modifying them for a different culture, a different era, so that I'm forgetting her name, of the ashes becomes, of the cinders,
yeah,
becomes Ashputtel.
Mm-hmm. Which was originally a Chinese fairy tale.
Yeah. There's a wonderful website called the Cinderella Project
mm-hmm.
that has, I don't know, 50 or more literary versions.
The variations.
Yeah. Yeah. All the variations and scholarly writings to go along with it. That's just, you know, just take a look at the one.
Mm-hmm.
And all the interesting variants that come on Beauty and the Beast alone. There was some kind of a French movie remake. That, and when I say remake, I mean a remake of the Renoir film,
mm-hmm.
as opposed, you know, which is still one of the great all-time classic fantasy movies of all time, is that version of Beauty and the Beast. But what it seems to, but it brings color and wonderful surrealism to it, but then they have to have the ballroom scene a la Disney, I guess, to give younger people a context, and their context today will be Disney. And for me, while Disney has done a wonderful job in telling a lot of stories and science fiction and so forth, they've also destroyed a lot of fairy tales to their own end.
Yeah, and I know, usually when I teach this fairy tale class, the next to last one is on Disney. In a sort of pseudo-defense of Disney is that fairy tales get changed over the course of time
yeah.
because they reflect society.
They're like
so it's really hard to take a hard-nosed line and say, well, fairy tales cannot change, or if they change, they can't change in the way that Disney changes them. Because Disney is both successfully and unsuccessfully, Disney is representing the culture that we now have, and the change that Disney imposes on fairy tales doesn't always work. But when it gets a generation of children to respond obsessively to Disney's version of the fairy tale, then I think we have to admit that there's something in that Disney version that matters to the children.
Yeah, I mean, the Snow Queen, way. You know, I did not love Frozen, but the Snow Queen is now not forgotten, which it had been for so many years, although there's a lovely Russian movie version of it that and see the Russian film with subtitles. The American version is very cut down and very Americanized, but the Russian one, which is on YouTube, is quite something. And of course closer, because it's not two sisters, it's a sister and a brother, etc., etc. And on the other hand, the fact that the Snow Queen has become this beloved thing for so many people today, as opposed to
the horrifying,
as opposed to a slasher film,
yeah,
which the same kids would probably be subject to,
or their brothers,
exactly. So it's and Disney has, I approve more or less, something I suspect Walt would not have, of a lot of their inclusiveness in politics and racial stuff. I mean, people are going, well, in Aladdin, the girl doesn't do this and the girl doesn't do that. And did anybody bother to notice that Aladdin was non-white as portrayed in the movie? And that was the first time in the cinema in that a cartoon lead character was something other than white from an American film. It was worth noting that Aladdin looked like Aladdin, which, you know, otherwise he's Douglas Fairbanks or some such. So, yeah, it's a complicated kind of a thing. But why change Peter Pan as much? That's not a fairy tale. That's J.M. Barrie, for God's sake. You know, it's like there was no need.
You know,
it's
funny. Every once in a while, there's a story that appeals to something that is not quite easily identified. That it's almost basic core psychology. And Peter Pan is one of those things.
Yeah.
So
Peter Pan and Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah.
I think,
God. You know, have you been? You must have seen Facebook is just constantly going through this thing of identify 10 books quickly without thinking that have influenced you that or stayed with you.
No, I have. I try to avoid Facebook memes.
It's really weird. I don't know why these things happen. I don't know why people actually do them.
Yeah.
You know, and I did because someone asked me to. You know, what are you going to do? But I won't send it forward, but it's interesting that people are very happy to identify 10 books. But top of my list is always Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah.
I think that if there's one book that influenced me, and I don't believe that I read Alice in Wonderland as a child. I don't believe I read it until I was around 17, 18. Mm-hmm. I spent a summer as an apprentice in summer stock in East Hampton, Long Island. And that's where I read, or someone read to me, Winnie the Pooh, and I think also Alice. I'm not quite sure. But
I was Winnie the Pooh and Dr. Doolittle. Boy, Dr. Doolittle would not stand, the literary one would not stand up today under any scrutiny whatsoever. And the movies have been pretty bad, too.
Yeah.
All of the different types.
Yeah.
And, let's see, Winnie the Pooh, Alice in Wonderland. The most, I don't know about currently, but about 15 years ago, there was a poll of science fiction fandom and writers. And the most common book among everybody was, you'd never believe it, The Wonderful Flight to the Mushroom Planet.
Never even heard of it.
Yeah, it's a, you know, fun little bizarre throwaway kind of science fiction book. You would figure it would be, you know, Madeleine L'Engle and Wrinkle in Time.
Do you know whether that's still being read as much? I guess it is.
Yeah. It's another book that has never been out of print, and there are rumors of the people who made Frozen
doing it.
doing it, not necessarily, you know, maybe for Disney, maybe not, but the producers of Frozen are, have optioned or are working on a ver-, I mean, movies are being discussed daily that never get made, only, you know, one out of 20 projects ever seen.
And that won't bother me if anyone out there wants to buy movie rights to anything I've written. You don't have to actually make it.
Well, yes, options. I mean, a lot of
option,
people.
Please.
Yes, Terry Bissonette one time had something like five options going.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
It's just cool. Delighted. I hope they never make any of these.
I'm fine with it either way.
Yeah,
just option away.
Options are great money for people.
Yeah.
I have been, by the way, I'm slightly concerned. We've got 90 seconds left.
Ooh.
And, yeah, and our replay, as I say, 90 minutes is way too short for this program.
That went very fast.
And it really does. And Lister, our replacement, is not here. So I'm watching these monitors that show people coming down the corridor. So before we move to whatever I am going to put on to replace us or cover for us or whatever, we will run a little bit over. Let me reiterate, this coming Tuesday at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, this month only at 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. That's Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue. BAI listeners should know that address. But this is at the ground floor. Admission is free. Contributions accepted. And our readers are Paul DiFilippo and Walter Mosley. And Tuesday, and doors open at 6:30, and come one, come all. We're going to get you back into that reading series. So you just read last Wednesday with Veronica Shaness, who, two weeks ago. Veronica was supposed to be here last week, but could not because she wasn't feeling well. And Richard Bowes came in. Now, time before last that he was on this program, he did a fairy tale.
Ah.
And he was some of his fairy tales are just stunning. Absolutely stunning, considering, you know, his view of the world and his outlook on all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
is absolutely fascinating. Your books currently in print are Glorious Plague.
Glorious Plague. Last year was The Inner City. The year before that,
wonderful goldfish on the cover.
Yes, wonderful goldfish. The year before that was The Made-Up Man, and then before that was Journey to Boehm Goody. Before that was The Soft Room, and then last but not least, or first actually, but not least, was another collection, The Other Door.
Right. Yeah, and these are all in print at this point?
As far as I know, they are all still in print.
Yeah.
One way or another.
So.
And a lot of them are available as ebooks.
Yeah.
I think everything but the first one.
So is there a common place like, you don't have a website, do you?
Yes, I do.
Oh, you do?
I do. It's a quiet website, but it's a website.
Okay. Yes, that's right. I have been there, but not since the last book came out.
But, yeah, you can get anything through Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com.
Yeah. But I usually like to send people to authors' websites.
Which is KarenHuler.com.
And that would be KarenHuler.
That's right.
Just so that people know that. So what I am going to do at this point is, first of all, thank you for being here.
I had a wonderful time. I'm so happy that you invited me again. Thank you so much.
Well, yeah, it's an open invite. You know, you're always welcome. And I will, I'm going to play my outro music at this point. It is conceivable that Lister will show up. He has a long way to travel and sometimes gets here late. We're this far uptown in Harlem, and if they do something to the one train, hold it at a station or something like that.
And you know they will.
And you know they will, and they do it all the time. time he's held captive, but I'm going to put on programming that will take us through to 5 a.m. And at 5 a.m., the archives come on. So, again, thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. We will be back next week from 1:30 to 3 a.m., allegedly. And, no, I don't yet have an absolute booking for that. That might turn out to be Veronica making up for last week's inability, or something else altogether. I also have in the can, as it were, an interview from ReaderCon with Sonia Samitar.
I love her work.
And she's wonderful. She's so cool.
Yes.
Listeners, watch out for that. So here's our outro music, and I don't even know what to tell you to stay tuned for. I'm going to figure it out now. In the meantime, good morning. Okay, well, we have made an executive decision here, and that is that in order to fill, it's, as I was saying, it's quite possible that Lister, who I knew wouldn't be here last week, but I haven't heard from him about this week, He may show up by 3:30, and what we will do at 3:30 is we will rebroadcast the 12 midnight Earth Watch retro program, and then at 5 a.m., the already scheduled from the archives. So Karen Hueller and I, Jim Freund, will fill by continuing to chat from now until 3:30, and if you want, we can ask for listener calls. So if you would like to be on topic, the telephone number is area code 212-209-2900. Again, 212-209-2900. And I don't need to once again promote the Mosley DiFilippo reading because people have already done that. To hear,
I know
the phone,
I'm going there.
Yeah. You're one of the first people to sign up.
Yes, that's right.
Hear the phone calls, you will need your headphones. And by the way, you don't have to sign up on Facebook in order to attend. You just need to show up. But I love when people go to the event on Facebook and click it because it encourages other people. And so far, I think it says we have like 31 people going. That's pretty good because you usually get about 2.5 to 3 times the number of people that click on Facebook that they are going. Only half of the people who say they're going will show up.
And I take away all the maybes.
Oh, I never.
Maybes are zero.
Maybes are zero, exactly. They're simply people who say, I support the fact that this is happening, but
I
live in Madagascar.
I just won't be there.
Yeah, exactly. And let's see now. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Yeah, Tom from the Bronx here.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah, I'd like to say that I was listening to the reading, and I thought that was fantastic. I thought it was a good reading.
Yes, you
well,
did.
Thank you so much. That's wonderful to hear. Thank you.
Yeah, and it is true about the ants that go to the top of the plant.
Yes.
Yeah, you took that from what scientific reading?
I don't remember where I came across it, but as I was and I looked it up one more time just to make sure that I didn't make it up. It's an NPV virus and a specific.
I heard recently somebody else was talking about that on the radio somewhere.
Oh.
And anyway, let's hope it doesn't give public officials or, you know, bad ideas.
Right.
Spread that ailment around to human beings.
Well, it'd be interesting if public officials all went to the highest point.
Yes. if we could just direct it.
And started singing.
But, of course, they didn't sing, though. In other words, in the report I heard, the ants didn't sing or anything.
And I just came across it. This is the kind of stuff that really fascinates me. And I just came across reading about there's a single-celled organism which can only reproduce in cat guts. When it infects a rat, it makes the rat unafraid of cat urine, upping the rodent's chances of getting eaten by a cat and returning the paper. You know, just one of these circular things. But I think it's absolutely, it's so strange that a parasite can change the behavior of the host.
But it also, the report I heard, was that if the body tells the body to eat something?
Yes.
In other words, it takes over the person's body or the
right. I mean, I've seen some references to it creating a zombie. In that it destroys.
Well, what it must, it's a fungus.
Yeah.
It's a fungus that does that.
Yes.
In other words, I imagine the mind is very.
That's what gets changed.
Off base by then, and it just can't help itself.
Yes.
Do you know anything about do you know anything about worms, like body worms? In other words, the
like tapeworms, you mean?
Yeah, tapeworms and stuff. Well, let me say this.
Well, we're digital nowadays, so we're not using
You're
as
not
many
using tapeworms anymore.
Yeah, but anyway, in Mexico, when the conquistadors came over, there was one town, Mexican town, they would never go into. And this is how stories, how demons, they talk about demons, the stories evolved. They claim that they have breeder worms. These people have breeder worms in them. To this day, this town should be dewormed.
Hmm.
The breeder worms do not kill their host. What they do is they put out eggs. The eggs go.